So last summer, we were at my parents' house in South Carolina, and we were on vacation, and my parents and my wife and I, we were trying to have a conversation, and so we do what all good parents do, and we put the television on for our kids, okay, in the background, and they began to watch some television, and all of a sudden, we weren't really paying attention to what they were watching, but my daughter says, "Dad, what is this?" And I got really scared. What do we put on? And we look over, and it's a commercial. Now, it's not that we're these great parents who our kids have never watched television before, but they've only watched Netflix. So because we've only streamed television, we don't have cable at our house, they had never, my daughter at the time was 4 years old, she had never seen a commercial. I had realized that even because, again, I watch Netflix occasionally, but I had not seen an actual television commercial in a long time. And so I began to watch these, and it's, you know, they've been around for a long time, I know that. But I began to watch these, and as I did, I thought, wow, every one of these commercials, when you don't see it for a while and then you watch it again, you go, these all have the same exact message to them. Every commercial basically says, aren't you tired of your bottled water? I mean, whatever it was, right? That aren't you tired of your carpet, you know? You don't want the same old, and it's some version of that. Aren't you dissatisfied? Don't you want something new? And really, it's an attempt, I'm not saying they maybe explicitly are always doing this, but implicitly, an attempt to make you feel discontent with what you have and to have a desire, often a covetousness desire, to have something that you don't have, but maybe your neighbor does, or maybe somebody else you know does. And so this commandment today is going to speak, in the 10th commandment, it's going to speak to our desires, and particularly our covetousness desires, our desire for things that are not ours. And we see this in a lot of different ways. We see this in the fact of how many storage unit complexes go up all over America. Have you ever, you know, again, it's not wrong or sinful to have a storage unit, to rent one. I've done it in different seasons. But think about it. They say that there are now 90 square miles of storage units in America, which they said that means that's three times the size of Manhattan, full of storage units, because even though we live in the largest homes of anybody in world history, even though we have incredibly large basements and large attics, and large walk-in closets, and two or three car garages, we still need to store extra stuff other places. And though we have more than ever before, we want more than ever before. And it's kind of this interesting cycle. And so this commandment speaks to this today, and it speaks to our culture today, because the largest religion in America is not Christianity, but consumerism. Consumerism, this religion, let me teach you what it teaches. It says, if you get more things in your hands, you'll be more satisfied with your heart. If more things happen and you get more things in your hands, your heart will be more satisfied. And so this commandment, the 10th and final commandment, confronts us, it confronts our culture, it confronts our desires. And so I want to read it together, and it's found in Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. If you want to turn there or type to Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, I'm going to read it and then make several comments about it. You shall not covet. That would be the short version of this commandment, but it's a much longer commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. And by the way, as I read this, look how often the word neighbor shows up in this commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet. One of the only commandments to be repeated twice. In this one commandment, we have the same commandment given twice. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. What an interesting final commandment. This commandment is unique in a lot of different ways, and I want to start out by talking about what makes the 10th and final commandment unique. Next week, we're going to look at that portion right afterwards where Moses says, fear God and you'll have nothing to fear in regards to the 10 commandments. But today and this weekend, we're dealing with the final commandment, which is do not covet, and it's unique in a lot of different ways. Think about it. The way you start something and the way you end something are very important. And so God started with the most important commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. That's one of the reasons we named the series No Other Gods. We thought, well, at least they're going to get one of these commandments. You know, they're going to at least understand one commandment if for 10 weeks we say, hey, the series is No Other Gods. So it's a very first and important commandment, have no other gods before me. But then the 10th commandment is very interesting. You ever notice how long it is? It's the longest commandment that deals with our relationship with man. So the 4th commandment is the longest commandment that deals with our relationship with God. It talks about the Sabbath and remembering and resting and who should do work and who should not do work. That's the 4th commandment, but the 10th commandment is the longest commandment that is horizontal in nature. In other words, the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th commandments are very short. Obey your parents. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Many of them are only two or three words in the Hebrew. And then we get to this commandment, and it's very long, and it's very repetitive. And he's giving us a lot of specific things. So the first thing that makes it interesting is that it's the last and longest commandment. Secondly, it's the commandment that the Apostle Paul, who wrote a large part of the New Testament, at least 13 letters, the Apostle Paul said it was the commandment that convicted him. So if you go back, you don't have to do this now, you may want to do this later this week. If you read Romans chapter 7, Paul shares about his struggle with sin. Paul talks about what's happened to him. And what's interesting, he doesn't mention any of the other 10 commandments, but says, when the commandment said, do not covet, it brought out in me all of these covetousness desires. And what he's saying is this commandment speaks to religious people and moral people. See, the other commandments, they're all, at least on the surface level, they're all very external. Let me give you an example. Do not murder. Very external. Now, we talked about Jesus makes it internal. He talks about hate. Do not commit adultery. Very external. Don't use my name in vain. Very external. Just don't do it. And so a religious and a moral person, and this happens a lot of times, religious people go, I've never broken these commandments. I keep the day, I keep the Sabbath day. I've never murdered anybody. I obey my parents. I don't lie. I don't steal. But then you get to the 10th commandment and you can't avoid it. It speaks to all of us, which leads to the most unique thing about it. It's the only completely internal commandment. It's the only commandment that is, from the very beginning, internal. It's about the heart. And it's the commandment under every other commandment. So why do we murder? Because we covet. In fact, James 4:2 says this, you desire and you do not have, so you murder. Well, why do we commit adultery? Well, it starts with lust. Well, guess what another word for lust is? A synonym for lust. Coveting. Why do we steal? Because we want other things. So coveting is the sin under all of the other sins. It's like idolatry. In fact, it's the psychological way to talk about idolatry. Paul himself in Colossians 3:5, he goes, I want you to know that idolatry is coveting. He actually just says that's what it is. Colossians 3:5, idolatry is coveting. So it's the repeating of the second commandment, have no idols, but given a more personal psychological way of talking about it in the sense of saying, do not covet. So I want to continue to look at this command. And one of the things it's telling us as we do is that Christianity is ultimately about the heart. You think about it. He ends the Ten Commandments, God does, in giving them to Moses to say, I've given you these Ten Commandments, and I want you as they end to know that ultimately this is about your heart being changed. That the greatest problem is something inside of you, not something outside of you. See, the gospel, the Christian message says this, your greatest problem is inside of you. The wrongful and sinful desires, the brokenness and the bankruptness of the human heart, your greatest problem is inside of you, and the solution is outside of you. The solution is what Jesus Christ did in time, space, history, living, dying, raising from the dead. So think about this. The greatest problem is inside of you, and the greatest solution is outside of you, which is the exact opposite of what everybody tells you. Everybody tells you your greatest problem is outside of you. It's your spouse. Your greatest problem is your job. The greatest problem is your home. The greatest problem is the lack of money that you have. The greatest problem is your kids. The greatest problem is your car. The greatest problem is your boss. It's not. The greatest problem is inside of you. The solution's outside of you. What they tell you is the solution's inside of you. The solution's inside of you. You just need to express yourself more. You need to find out who you really are. You need to read a lot of self-help books. It's the exact opposite of what the Christian message says. The Christian message says you have desires in you that are evil. And Jesus Christ has lived and died and rose from the dead and is willing to forgive. The solution is outside of yourself. This is at the heart of the Christian message, which is a reminder to us that when we, those of us in here who are parents, we need to get to the heart issues with our children. And that's a lot harder to do than just screaming at them, scaring at them, staring at them, screaming at them, shaming them, making them feel guilty, commanding them. Not that I've ever done any of those things, okay? But I've heard about people who do that. But it's a lot easier to do that, right, than to actually go, okay, I know she just lied. And instead of just sending her to her room, I'm going to get at eye level, and we're going to talk about why we lied and what was going on in our heart when we lied. And what did we really... Well, that's time-consuming. It's emotional. It takes a lot of energy. You got to do it a lot. But this is what God is willing to do with us. God is willing to say, okay, I wrote a long book. I understand the human heart, and I'm going to diagnose it. And I want to remind you with the 10th commandment that Christianity is ultimately about internal transformation, not behavior modification. You don't need to change your behavior as much as you need to be born again. And a person who's born again, we've talked about this, they get new taste buds, new desires. They have the power and the presence of the Holy Spirit. And so what makes this commandment unique is how internal it is. Well, what is coveting? I want to give you a definition. I try to always define terms because when things are not defined, they remain fuzzy in our mind, which isn't helpful because then you ask the question, well, am I coveting? What's the difference between coveting and just liking something? Well, what am I not supposed to have desires at all? Well, how does this work? So let me give you a very simple and I think a helpful working definition of coveting. So simple, you probably don't have to write it down. You can remember this. But coveting is a desire that makes you discontent. Coveting is when you have a desire in your heart. It could be a desire for a good thing, marriage, family, money, job, kids, car, new neighborhood. It could be something good, but it is a desire that makes you discontent and often resent other people. It's twofold. There's the first part that just you're just discontent with your life, but then you resent people. You resent them because they married that person, live in that home, work at that job, make that much money. And that's what's wrong with us. It makes us discontent. Pride is one of the biggest reasons behind our discontentment and our coveting. We get prideful because the truth is we don't just want to have a nice house. We want to have a nicer house than other people. They did studies. This was fascinating. They did a study on how happy somebody is in their home. Here's what they found out. It had nothing to do with the home they lived in, but their home in relationship to the other homes in their neighborhood. So they found out that it didn't matter how many square feet you had. It didn't matter how big your ceilings were and how many bathrooms and bedrooms you had. It mattered how did your house compare to your neighbors. And they found that if somebody had a 1,500 square foot house but all their neighbors had a 1,000 square foot house, they felt pretty happy. But if they had a 1,500 square foot house and all their neighbors had a 2,500 square foot house, they didn't feel as happy. Because we tend to look to the left and look to the right and we tend to play the compete, compare, conquer game. And so this is what was happening with people. This is why, I don't know why I remember this, but I remember being in middle school and coming downstairs and my dad would always be up early reading the newspaper. And he was reading the Wall Street Journal like he always does. And he goes, Kyle, I read the truest statement today in something that's so true in the Wall Street Journal. You're not usually excited about the Wall Street Journal, but let's talk about it, you know? So he said, it said this statement, men don't want to be rich. They want to be richer than other men. It's not so much about having stuff, it's having more stuff. It's the opposite of loving your neighbor. It's competing, comparing, being envy, being jealous with your neighbor. And we all struggle with this. Let me give you a few examples. If you don't think already you struggle with this, don't answer this out loud, but let me ask you a few questions. If you could have the car of anybody, who would it be? What car would it be? For some of you, it might be a truck. For others of you, a minivan. Some of you, a luxury vehicle. Others of you, a motorcycle. If you could have the house, the home of anybody, whose home would it be? Whose home do you wish you had? If you could have the abilities, the skills, socially, emotionally, spiritually, you wish you had the relational skills, you wish you had the athletic skills, the academic skills, the education. If you could have anybody's physical appearance, who would it be? Do you wish you were thinner, taller, tanner? Do you wish you were shorter, stronger, smaller? It's different depending on what you covet. If you could have anybody's possessions, what would you like and whose would they be? And there's been movies made about this. If you could trade lives with somebody else, whose life would you want to trade with? As you begin to think about that, it probably brought out in you some of those desires. And you thought, okay, I know what this feels like to covet. Well, let's be honest. Facebook doesn't help. Okay, I love Facebook, but Facebook, does it cause some people to covet? I think so. Continually putting pictures on, continually celebrating. How many times do you see somebody and you're like, oh, they're in a relationship. Great. You know? Before me. I'm not angry or jealous or anything. How did he get married? You know, like we watch these things and we begin to covet. You know, people are always taking pictures of what they bought. You see, oh, he bought a new car. How much does he make? They're at IKEA again? You know? You see people traveling, taking photos, and you think, oh, man, you're not happy for them. What you're thinking is, how many weeks of vacation do they have? Who's watching their kids? I mean, I wish my first response was always to go, oh, they must be having a great time. You know, they need that. This is really great. But oftentimes our response can be coveting. Oh, I wish I could have that type of freedom, flexibility. Sometimes we are jealous of people's kids. Oh, it's so great their kids got into that school. How can they afford private school? You know, we begin to have all of these questions and it changes as you age. You have different things to compare, to compete, and to try to conquer. And that's what ends up happening. What happens is you look at someone's life and they're excelling in an area you're not, and you're jealous and you're envious and you're coveting. So what you do is you try to find an area you're doing better with them. You play the numbers game. Oh, I'm 30 and they're 30 and they make more money than me and they have a better house, but I'm married and I live in a better city and I have more friends. And you play this sick, we all play this sick game of competing, comparing. And it leads either to pride, I'm doing great, or to another form of pride, despair, oh, poor me, I'm not as good as, I don't have, God hasn't given it to me. So this coveting speaks to all of us and can lead to pride, always leads to pride. And this isn't a new problem, it didn't come out with Facebook. It happened at the very beginning with Adam and Eve. In fact, you can take all 10 of these commandments and draw them back to Adam and Eve. Think about what happened at the garden. God said you can have all of these trees and all of these food, and all of the plants and all of the garden except this one tree and this one food. And then what did they want? They desired what they were not able to have, and they were discontent and disappointed, and then they listened to the devil. And the devil will always be there when you're struggling with contentment, when you're being discontent, when you are coveting. The devil will always be there, and he'll lie, and he'll always tell you, he'll always make you think about the things you don't have instead of focusing on all that God's given you. In fact, think about it. He just lies to him. He says, if you eat this, you will be like God. They already were like God. They were made in God's image. They even already had it. He tricked them. This is what Satan does. He lies to us to make us feel like what we have is insignificant, insufficient, and that we need something more and something else. And there's two ways this happens in the human brain. I want to explain these with terms you may never have heard before. The first term is the term focalism. They talk about this term, focalism is the idea, and this happens in the human brain, that you can only, and this is what happens when we covet, you can only see the thing you want and everything else becomes fuzzy. This is why somebody, they sit down with some vacation package and some kind of timeshare thing, and all of a sudden it's all they can see. They can't think, wait a second, I can't afford this, I can't do this. This is why someone goes to buy a house and get a mortgage and they don't even realize, I can't afford this. This doesn't fit into my lifestyle, my salary, because they see one thing they want. This is also the reason why a man is able to leave his wife and young children, get divorced, marry some other woman, leave some other woman. You think, how could he do that? How could he do that to some woman, to some kids? It's because of focalism. He can only see, I'm not excusing it at all, it's a sin, but he can only see that one thing. The other issue at work, it's focalism. They work together. It's focalism and a thing called impact bias. Impact bias is why you have buyer's remorse. Impact bias makes things appear bigger and better than they are. So you get the iPhone and you spend a lot of money, you take it home, you're like, it's just like my other iPhone. But it felt better at the store. You know, it's like the iPhone didn't change. But for a moment, you probably had a version of focalism and impact bias. In which things looked bigger and better. Again, this is why a certain car, a certain home, a certain person. I remember I heard a pastor first explain these terms, and he was talking to a room of about 10,000 men. And he was explaining this, and he was saying to the men, there will be a time in your life, maybe not all of you, he goes, but there'll be a time in your life where some other woman will catch your attention, and you're going to begin to be tempted to think about her way or move toward her in a certain way. And he just stopped, and he said, talking about the principle of impact bias. He goes, she's not that hot. She looks hotter to you than she really is. She looks better. It looks better. It looks bigger. He looks better. And our brains and Satan are lying to ourselves, and we're not focusing on what we have. We're focusing on what we don't have. So secondly, I want to ask this question, what do we covet today? Well, the answer is the same things they coveted back then. A lot of times, C.S. Lewis says, today in America, we can do what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery. In other words, we look back at the people back then and we're like, ha, 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 they rode around on donkeys. They had ox that treaded the grain. You know, like, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. And then you read it, you're like, ah, no, I covet the same things. You're right. Okay. Several thousand years later, and the human condition has not changed at all. So God, in his kindness, actually gives us a very specific list of things that, for all time, every person will struggle to be content and instead be tempted to covet. Let me give you them in the order they appear. We'll go through these quickly. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. Glad that's not a problem anymore, right? Yeah, whoo, no. Have you ever gone over someone's house and you came back home and you're like, man, my kitchen's so small. I have no stainless steel appliances. Why? I didn't know my backyard was this small. It's not fenced in. I don't have outdoor living spaces. You know, like you just go over someone else's house and you begin to realize, nothing wrong with having a nice house. You begin to realize nothing's wrong with even realizing they have a nice house. But when you begin to be discontent, when you have a desire that leads you to be discontent with the home that you have. Sometimes that's because of the neighborhood, the square footage, the amenities. But it's very, very true. In fact, I think a lot of the shows on HGTV are not super helpful in helping us be content with our home. Okay, nothing against Chip and Joanna Gaines, okay? But Love It or List It, House Hunters, Flip or Flop, Fixer Upper, and Property Brothers, I've seen some of those myself. Nothing wrong with them in themselves. Sometimes they give you great ideas for your home. Sometimes they cause you to be discontent with your home and covet other people's homes. So just something to think about. Secondly, we tend to, what it says here, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. We can enlarge this to spouse. Again, very relevant for today. I won't spend a lot of time talking about this because we spent a lot of time talking about this in the seventh commandment, do not commit adultery. What I want to say, though, is something that a man said to me years ago to a bunch of us, single guys. He was in his 40s. He'd been married for years, and he was just kind of a guy's guy, and he pulled us together one night, single guys. We were down at a Christian camp kind of thing, and he pulled us together, and we were talking about marriage and dating and all these other things. He goes, here's what's one thing I want you guys to remember. The perfect spouse does not exist. It's a very simple concept, but the perfect spouse does not exist. We all have this idea of perfect spouse. For the guy, the perfect spouse, and am I stereotyping? I am, okay? But stereotypes tend to be true in a lot of cases, so let me do this. For the guy, the perfect spouse is super attractive, but also thinks you're attractive. Is super smart, but willing to follow you. Is godly, in shape, the perfect mom, meets all the needs of you and of those in the house. She's funny, but also thinks you're funny. She's secure and confident, but is willing to follow you. She's very feminine, but loves all the same things you do. She doesn't exist, you know? The truth is that person or whatever variation in your head does not exist. For women, and I have no idea what I'm talking about here. But I'm going to try just for a moment. They want a man who's passionate and adventurous, yet nurturing and caring. They want a man who's got a great job, makes a lot of money, but lots of free time and available to be with them. They want a man who's very confident, but better be nowhere near arrogant. They want a man who makes them laugh, but he better not be a goofball. They want a man who can lead them, but he better be very patient and understanding. He doesn't exist. I'm sorry. That man, the perfect man, whatever he is in your brain, whatever the perfect woman is in your brain, she doesn't exist. And here's what happens. This is why I say this. Because you get married and you begin to realize, this happens with everybody, you begin to realize, I didn't marry the perfect spouse because I'm not the perfect spouse. The perfect spouse doesn't exist. And what can happen is you can begin to see certain attributes in another person's spouse that your spouse doesn't have, or you don't think he has, you don't think she has, and it can cause you to covet. If you remind yourself the perfect spouse doesn't exist, I want to be thankful for the spouse God gave me. God gave Adam one choice. Here's Eve. God gave Eve one choice. Here's Adam. Your spouse is your standard of beauty. Is your spouse thin? That's your standard of beauty. Did your spouse gain a little bit of weight? New standard of beauty, you know? Whatever it is, your spouse is your standard of beauty. Third, He says, don't only covet your neighbor's house. Don't covet your neighbor's house. Don't covet your neighbor's wife. And then he makes this phrase, don't covet his male servant or his female servant. I believe this is speaking to lifestyle, to his economic status, and to his job. In other words, where does a person have servants? Or you could say employees today, maybe. So it's easy to look out and go, yeah, that'd be great if I had people working for me too. I could do that. If I had an administrative assistant, if I had a secretary, yeah, life would be a lot easier for me too. Or you can just begin to look at people's life at home and go, they have a lot of people who do stuff for them. Somebody else watches their kids. Somebody else cuts their grass. Somebody else cleans their home. Somebody else teaches their kids. And it can just begin to lead to jealousy and envy in the heart. Next, someone's possessions. And he mentions two, the ox and the donkey. I think that in general speaks to all possessions, but you think, what was the ox? The ox was the technology of the day. The ox was the ability to make your life at home and at work easier. Well, what was the donkey? The donkey was the transportation of the day. Sure glad that we don't covet anyone's technology and transportation today, except, of course, that we do. Whatever it is, whether it's the phone or how many screens or the conveniences or the, you don't even know this until you get married and you get a house, you're like, why am I coveting kitchen appliances? Like, what has my life become? But this happens, okay? This happens. So you just begin to covet internally, and it could be anybody's possessions. And then finally, number five, he just gives a junk drawer because he knows that we're all sinful and we're going to go, well, I don't covet those things. Well, he goes, well, anything, okay? We are sinful. The heart is not only an idol factory, it's a coveting factory. So sometimes you just covet other people's just whole life. You're like, I wish I had rich people problems. The AC unit's broke on your third home. Sorry. You know, it's like, okay, it's easy for me to covet anything in a person's life. It's very, very easy because the heart is an idol factory. So let me ask you this question. Who are you jealous of? Be honest, who are you jealous of? It's really hard for you to hear about that person spoken of nicely. In fact, every time you do, you got to go, well, I mean this with total respect, but let me just tell you this. And you begin to say something about them. Who is it for you? For a lot of people, it's their sibling. A lot of times, it's very hard to see your brother or your sister succeed in certain areas, and you feel like you haven't. And all of a sudden, it's Christmas, or it's Thanksgiving, or there's some kind of family vacation, and you start realizing how different your lives are. How much more they make, or how much easier their life is, or how much nicer their house is. And it becomes very difficult to be excited and to love them. Because here's the point. If you remember one thing I say today, there's a lot in here. If you remember one thing I say today, I think it's this. And this is why I think God gave us this commandment. Remember, he didn't give these commandments to individuals. He gave it to an entire community of people. And today, he gives it to the church. And I think this is why he gave it. He's saying this. You can't love somebody if you're jealous of them. That's the simple message here. You cannot love somebody if you're coveting what they have. You can't love your Christian brother or your non-Christian friend, neighbor. You can't. I mean, don't we want to be a church that just loves one another? We want to be a church that's content enough with what we have that we're even able to obey the commandment. I want to rejoice with those who rejoice. But some of us, some of you, are jealous and envious, and so sadly, that person who got a pay raise can't tell you because you couldn't handle it. Or they get an inheritance and they just want to share about that. Hey, it's great. I got an inheritance. It was amazing. It's going to be a huge blessing. You can't stand it. They want to tell you that they're pregnant and what happened and how excited. You hate it. We probably all experienced it on the other end where you felt like someone was jealous of you and you're like, I can't tell them that. Don't tell them we moved. Don't tell them where we live. They can't rejoice with me, which is the exact opposite. We're supposed to love our neighbor. You can't love your non-Christian friends if you're jealous of them. I think I've told you before, I struggled with this when I was at Duke. I was doing college ministry, and it was like a whole other world. And I just all of a sudden, I'm hearing these guys' lifestyles and what they do on the weekends, and they live in New York City, and they have second homes all over, and their life seemed amazing. And I remember it was hard for me at times to go, I need to share the gospel with you, but first I need to stop being jealous of you and see your condition as somebody in need of God's grace. And so the reason God's given us this commandment is for our good and for the good of our neighbors. Community happens when two people are content. And you can say, man, I'm so excited about that inheritance. That's going to be a huge blessing for you and your family. Man, that's amazing that you're getting married. I'm so excited for you. That's the type of community. I saw this with the associate pastor that I worked with several years ago. He was one of the, is still is, one of the most humble and godly men I've ever met. And he had the ability, and may this be said of all of us, he had the ability to be more excited about what was happening in your life than you were. And I believed it was completely real. So he, you'd come and you'd tell him, I remember we got a brand new minivan. And at the time, he did not have a great minivan. And this was years ago, and I told him, he goes, that is so exciting. I want to see it. I want you to tell me all about it. I want to see the, and it was like totally excited for me. Even though he wasn't getting a new minivan anytime soon, he was able to kind of get outside of himself and love me enough and see the connection enough to rejoice with me. We have to be able to love our neighbor. Because here's the main lie coveting tells you. The main lie coveting tells you is you will be satisfied in the next stage of life or economic status. 10 more thousand, 20 more thousand, you will be satisfied. Or next stage of life, you will be satisfied. It starts in high school. When you get out of your parents' house, you will be content. And then you get to college, and it's when you get out and you get a real job and you're making your own money and you live in your own place and you choose the city you want to live in, you'll be content. And then it becomes when you make X amount of money, you'll be content. And then it becomes, no, when I'm done renting and I own a home, I'll be content. No, when I have kids. No, when my kids are out of their diapers. No, when my kids have their license. No, when my kids are in college. No, when I'm done paying for college. Oh, when my kids will come back. When my kids will bring their grandkids. You see how it's, and here's how we all know that contentment is not found in a season of life, because as soon as you got in a new season, you began to covet your old season. You're like, oh man, life was a lot different when I was in college. Sometimes I wish I was back there. Sometimes I remember what life was like before kids, before marriage, whatever it is, before that job, before that responsibility. And so coveting is never satisfied, because think about it, coveting is about having what you don't have. So as soon as you have it, you don't want it anymore. That's kind of the nature of coveting. And the truth is, coveting has affected many of your relationship with God. In other words, you can be angry and bitter at God for not giving you something you desire. Even though for God may, out of love for you, say, this isn't the right time. And me not giving you this doesn't mean you've done something wrong. It doesn't mean I don't love you. You're my child. But sometimes we want things so bad, and in return, we resent God. We're angry at God for not giving us something instead of, again, focusing on all that God's given us. So what is the cure? What is the cure? The cure is contentment. I've talked about this again. If coveting is a desire that makes you discontent and often resent other people, the cure is contentment. The Apostle Paul, the same man, and he was a man. Sometimes we think about him as like a superhero. He was a man. The Apostle Paul, he said, the same man who said in Romans 7 that I covet. And that's what really convicted me. That same man says in Philippians 4, I learned the secret to being content. And you're going to see two different times here he says, it's something I had to learn. I didn't get it as soon as I became a Christian. I didn't get it just because I was an apostle. I didn't get it because I wrote scripture. I had to learn this. Look what he says. Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I'm to be content. I know how to be brought low. And man, did Paul know how to be brought low. He was flat broke, homeless, shipwrecked, without food. And I know how to abound. Paul lived a very rich lifestyle as a Pharisee for a long time. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need, and then a verse that we all take out of context. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It's not about being a better athlete. That verse is about the ability to be content in all of life because Christ is enough. Because Christ will be there with you and help you. A couple thoughts on contentment as we think about this. First of all, contentment has to do with a thankful heart. Contentment has to do with having a very thankful heart. In fact, in Romans 1, there's this interesting phrase. Paul says, they worship creation over creator. In other words, they commit idolatry. He says, the reason they do it is because their hearts are darkened. And we're like, okay, I get that. Their hearts are darkened. He goes, and they're ungrateful. That's why. Their hearts are darkened, I get, but the reason they worship false things and they don't love God is because they're ungrateful. In other words, one of the ways to cultivate a deeper relationship with God and to be content and to not covet is to just be thankful. Practice being thankful for your friends, for your home, for your spouse, for your car, for your carpet, whatever it is that you're not happy with right now. Practice being, and here's the interesting thing. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't love my car, okay? It's not a bad car. I've got a good car. I've had it for eight years or so now, and it was the most basic model when I got it, and, you know, it can't even fit three car seats in the back of it now, you know? It's not the greatest car. I'm grateful for it, you know, after this week, because I just took some time and just said, I'm just going to spend some time thanking God for my car. And it was just amazing what happens in the human heart when you just focus on how thankful you are. God, thankful that it has AC. Thankful that it has heat. God, thankful that it doesn't break down on me. Thankful I'm able to get from place to place. And it's just, in all areas of life, there's a power in the discipline of thankfulness in our lives. Let's cultivate that together. And particularly being thankful for the gospel. One of my pastors in the past, his name's Andy Davis, he used to say this all the time. He would say, God, there's nothing God can do to make you any more happy. In other words, he's done everything necessary to make you happy. He has done the main thing in the gospel. Think about it. God has, if you're a Christian in this room, God has forgiven your sin. God has adopted you as a son or daughter. God has given you his Holy Spirit. God has promised you eternal life with him. There's nothing God can do. He's done all the main things he's promised to do to make you happy forever. They're already done. Everything else is kind of icing on the cake. And so if we would take some time just to be thankful for the gospel and thankful for our salvation, not that we don't need other things. Paul says, he'll say later, I've learned to be content as long as I have food and clothing. So he talks about basic needs, but he talks about contentment in this life. Secondly, contentment is not about being rich or poor. Contentment is not about being rich or poor. Paul says, I was rich and I was poor and I learned how to be content. Jesus, very unique, was rich, poor, and rich again. Rich when he was in heaven, poor when he came to the earth, lived in what people think today is probably the size of a parking stall, house, one parking spot, house. That was probably the size of Jesus' house. So very rich in heaven, very poor on earth, very rich again in heaven. Content, content, content. So the lie that we believe is, man, if I just got more stuff, I'd be content. And rich people know that's not true. And sometimes they even think the opposite. If I can get rid of my stuff, I'll be content. And you realize it's actually not about what's in your hand, it's about what's in your heart. Contentment is about a thankfulness and a gratefulness for what God has done in your life and thankful for the life God has given you. Contentment also takes an eternal perspective. 1 Timothy 6 says this, but godliness with contentment is great gain. Translation, the good life. In other words, being godly, having a relationship with God, living a godly life, and being content is the good life. And then he gives this reason. For we brought nothing into this world, and we can take nothing out of it. Eternal perspective. The gospel is the only thing that can make us content forever. Finally, contentment comes from believing God's promises. Keep your life, this is Hebrews 13:5, keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. And then that word for giving you the reason. For God has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. In other words, this sounds overly simple, but God's saying, would you believe what I said? Believe that I am enough for you. And I may bless you with other things, but believe that I'm enough. I was just talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about when we read the Bible and we're confronted with what God says, and we're like, oh, so you say I should believe that you're enough, and that's what you've called me to do. I learned something new about God. I guess I better change my mind. I better change my mind about how I view God. I better begin to change my mind so that it aligns with what the Scripture says. So I want to begin to believe God and believe that the emotions will follow, the affections will follow. I want to begin to obey with my mind and my will and believe the affections will follow. See, the truth is this, the world is not attracted to Christians when we're full of coveting desires, just like they are. When the world comes in, when they visit your community group, maybe they're over at your house, maybe they're at your work, and they see that your desires are the exact same as theirs. You're doing the exact same thing with your time, the exact same thing with your money, you're climbing the same ladders leaned against the same walls as they are. And so when you tell them you have this great hope, they're like, no, you don't. But when 1 Peter 3 says, be ready to give an answer for the hope that's in you, that means that you're living differently. You maybe make less than they do and you're content. You live in a smaller house than they do and you're content. Your car is not as nice and you're content. You don't take as nice of vacations and you're content. Does that make sense? They begin to look at your life and go, wait a second, if I was in your situation, I wouldn't be content. There's got to be something else going on inside of you that allows you to feel content. And also, what's amazing is you're still excited about me. You're excited about what's happening in my life. You're excited about my home and my house and my kids and my mom. You're excited for me and you're excited for your other Christian friends. I've never seen anything like that. Would you tell me about what's going on inside of you and how you're able to think like that? And that's the opportunity to share the gospel. Finally, I want to clarify something as we talk about contentment, though, and it's this. We're called to be content, but not to be complacent. So contentment is a biblical command and teaching to be content, but we're never called to be complacent. And here's the difference. Complacency has to do with virtue, with character. We should never be complacent when it comes to virtue and character. In other words, you should never say, I'm complacent or I'm content with the sin of my life. You should never say, I'm content with how godly I am. I'm content with how hardworking I am. I'm content with my relationship with God. In fact, one of my favorite things is at the end of the fruit of the Spirit list, it says this, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, all of this. And then it says, against such things there is no law. Have you ever wondered why it says that? Against such things there is no law. It means this, you can't max it out. You can't max it out. You can't love too much. Can't do it. I was too self-controlled. Impossible. I was too kind. I was too faithful. And amazing. In other words, I don't ever want to be content in my character. I want to be content with what in my possessions, in my property. I want to be content in my relationship with people. But I want to look to Jesus Christ, who is the great example of being content, being rich, being poor, being rich, and is the great example of never being complacent. We see him in Mark chapter 1 up early in the morning pursuing his relationship with God. We see him busy at work, healing, teaching, preaching. Jesus Christ lived a life that was content but never complacent. In fact, Jesus Christ did the exact opposite of coveting. We could summarize coveting as saying this, I want what you have. And therefore, I'm full of desires that make me discontent. I want what you have. The gospel says, I'm going to give you what's mine. That's what Jesus Christ said. Jesus Christ said, here's what I have. It's my life. Nobody takes it from me. I lay it down and I raise it up again. But what I'm willing to do is I'm not here. This is what he would say all the time. People would say, why are you here? He goes, I'm not here to be served. But I'm here to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many so that you can be content, true contentment in me forever. So as the band comes up and as the prayer team comes forward, I want to challenge us in three specific areas. The first area is to cultivate good desires in your life. Cultivate good desires. In other words, this is not a commandment that says do not have desires. It's saying do not have desires that make you discontent. But positively, have good desires. Have a desire to serve. Have a desire to be generous. Have a desire to pray. Have a desire to work on your marriage. Have a desire to love your kids. Have a desire to walk with God. Have so many strong desires that your soul is so large that when sin comes in, it looks small. A large soul full of great desires makes sin look really small. But a small soul that's just all about itself, when sin comes in, sin looks really big and really beautiful. And the whole impact bias and the focalism thing happens. So first and foremost, cultivate in your mind and heart good desires. Secondly, realize that the Christian life is a paradox. In other words, if you decide, I'm not going to listen to this, I'm not going to listen to Kyle, I'm going to continue to covet, I'm going to continue to go after things, realize this, if you're going to continue to go after comfort, then you're going to only find misery. That's how it works. If that's all you're going to pursue, if that's your greatest desire, if what you want is just love, You'll probably end up finding loneliness. If what you want is ultimately just significance, you'll probably find rejection. If what your main goal in life is to have control, you'll probably find your life as chaotic. If you want to have a great reputation, you'll probably be humiliated many times. But the truth is, if we go after Christ, we get him and all that comes with him. That's the great promise of Scripture. So let us do that. Let us go after Christ. And then finally, let us cultivate a spirit of thanksgiving. Let us be a people who are thankful, who express our thankfulness for one another and encouraging one another. Express thankfulness to our spouses and to our kids. Let us be a place that is thankful, grateful, humble, and content so that the world is attracted to us as a salty and a bright community. Let's pray. Lord, we are so thankful for the Ten Commandments. You love us so much, you gave it to us.